This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's interview with poet Richard Blanco. Last month, Blanco read his poem One Today at President Obama's inauguration. Blanco's the youngest of America's five inaugural poets. He just turned 45. He's also the first Latino and first openly gay person in that role. Richard Blanco grew up in Miami after his parents emigrated from Cuba in 1968. He now lives in Maine with his partner. Blanco's the author of three collections of poems. The latest is called Looking for the Gulf Motel.
Richard Blanco, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to talk with you after hearing you read your wonderful poem on Inauguration Day. So I've asked you to read an excerpt of One Today, your inaugural poem, and I've chosen a couple of my favorite verses. So this begins with the second verse. The first verse is the opening with, you know, one sun rising over so many different people with so many different days ahead of them. So if you could pick up with the second.
Sure. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. Pencil yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges arrayed like rainbows, begging our praise. Silver trucks heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us, on our way, to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry or ring up groceries as my mother did for 20 years so I could write this poem for all of us. All of us, as vital as the one light we move through. The same light on blackboards with lessons for the day, equations to solve, history to question, or atoms imagined, the I have a dream we keep dreaming, or the impossible vocabulary of sorrow that won't explain the empty deaths of 20 children marked absent today and forever. Many prayers, but one light, breathing color into stained glass windows, life into the faces of bronze statues, warmth onto the steps of our museums and park benches as mothers watch children slide into the day.
You refer in that verse to the massacre in Newtown in which 20 children were killed. You gave this inaugural poem a month after the massacre. How did you decide to include it? And how did you think about how to include it? I thought what you wrote was just beautiful. The empty deaths of 20 children marked absent today and forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was, of course, in the emotional landscape of what was happening while I was writing the poem. And it just, as it struck us all so deeply, at the time I could barely watch the news, but I just, something emotionally in me felt that it was just right to include it. At the same time, in a poem like this, you want to be very careful to not sort of throw in references that are just gratuitous or for the sake of enlivening the poem in some way or in some, you know, shaping the poem in some way that feels disingenuous. But that part, I lived through that whole thing while I was writing the poem, and I wanted someplace for it to be recorded in this very moment. Because what I find interesting also about the inaugural poem, as I said, almost like a subgenre, is that it's a unique snapshot of where we are as a country at that moment.
So in a poem that simultaneously celebrates difference and commonality in America, you mention personal things about your family. You don't mention that you're gay. Did you say to yourself, oh, okay, I'm going to leave that out of the poem, or did it just not fit in the poem? Was it not relevant to the poem?
You know, that was one of the hardest challenges of the poem itself overall. It was how to at once sort of put myself in there, but, you know, realizing that this poem isn't about me. It's about our country.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that means in its totality. Part of the process that I went through was deciding what was important enough to me that I felt I needed to put in there. And, of course, the first impulse was to sort of, because I was the youngest, first openly gay, first Hispanic or Latino, the first impulse was kind of, I have to represent all this in the poem and, you know, sort of be more of in-your-face kind of poem. And then I took a step back from that and I realized, well, yes, it's all those things, but then there's I think there's a larger platform here, a larger sense of what America is that I needs to come through in the poem. I didn't have any specific references to my sexuality in here. It, you know, in the creative process, sometimes things come up, sometimes they don't. But sort of if you see the texture of the poem is about these people going through their days and whatnot. And I always, in the back of my mind, I had always thought about my father and my mother. Even the moment I heard the news, after it sunk in for about a couple hours, I was overcome with a sense of gratitude and understanding that all this was sort of happened because of all the sacrifices and hard work that my parents did to had to let my brother and I have a better life, education, et cetera, et cetera. The sort of the more typical sort of immigrant or exile story in my case. And so I felt like that was really part of my emotional center for this poem was my mother and my father and my ancestors, so to speak, the people that got up here, the people that ushered me forward into this world in more ways than one.
Your parents left Cuba in 1968. Why did they leave him and why at that moment?
As far as I understand, because, of course, it's nothing like living through something like that, the revolution was obviously 58, 59. So historically, as I understand it, there was a lot of momentum after the revolution and people weren't sure exactly what was going on or how things were moving. And I think slowly throughout the years, they saw the changes that they weren't keen on. And I think they saw that they, you know, it's again, you know, the typical sort of American exile immigrant dream of a better life, someplace that also means freedom and liberty and all the rest. And I think they went for that reason. And it was by 10 years after revolution, I think they made that decision. And back then, of course, there was no diplomatic, as there is now, no official diplomatic relations with Cuba, so we had to go to Spain as a third country, they used to call it, before coming to the United States. But I think their motivations were very similar for the reasons that people come to America from all over the world in that sense. You know, my dad wasn't a political prisoner or anything like that, but there was a sense of just not wanting to, not agreeing with what was going on and seeing a better life for themselves and my brother and I.
You talk about we left Cuba.
You
were in utero. You were still.
Yeah.
Your mother was pregnant with you when the family left for Spain.
Yeah, I always say I always claim that my soul is Cuban. My soul was made in Cuba, and I was assembled in Spain and then imported to the United States because I was only 45 days old actually when we left Spain for Manhattan. And so my green card photo is actually my first baby photo. So, and I always say when I the first time I went back to Cuba, I always say, and it's like, and it does feel literally like you're going back because there's so much, you grow up with so much family lore, so many photographs and stories and things like that, that you feel like you have been there in some way emotionally. So it's when you do go, it does feel like a going back, a sort of things coming back to life.
So you're a poet, so words are obviously very important to you. How good was your parents' English when you were growing up? And were you fluent in Spanish? What language did you use in the house?
In our house, we spoke Spanish. After several years, maybe when I was around already 9 or 10, my parents could understand enough English that we would speak to them in English in parts, and they would answer us in Spanish, but they hardly ever spoke English to us. I don't ever remember having a first language. As far as I can remember, I've always known Spanish and English, and I was the first, speaking of other firsts, I was the first in my house that I remember that actually started learning English because my brother was six and a half years older. So I remember my parents asking me, how do you say this in English? How do you say that in English? From the time I was like maybe 4 or 5 years old.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem from Looking for the Gulf Motel that's about your father. It's called The Port Pilot. And some of the lines in this poem refer to various jobs your father had. He was a meat butcher in a butcher shop. Did he work in a bank for a while? Is that the reference to counting money?
He was a bookkeeper.
A bookkeeper.
Okay. By trade.
Okay. So those are the two things I wanted to mention before you read the poem. Is there anything else you'd like to say before you read it?
Well, the genesis of this poem had to do with my finding out one day, many years after, that my father was a port pilot. And, of course, Miami, there's these big cruise ship terminals. And one day my mom tells me that's what your dad studied or was going to do in Cuba. He was a port pilot. And so I just found that so interesting, that little factoid about my dad's life that I had never known before. And this is what happens when you grow up sort of in an exile family or immigrant family. You just get little pieces of information like throughout the years, and you got to piece all this stuff together. And so this is sort of piecing together some of my father. The port pilot. Before I knew him as a butcher coming home with bloodstains on his cuffs that Mama could never wash out in the kitchen sink. Before I learned he'd spend all day in the sky in loafers and a necktie counting other people's money in a tower with a view he couldn't afford. Years before he started gambling with me on cockfights at Dio Buridi's farm every Saturday night, teaching me how to bet on death. Long before he was diagnosed and staying alive became his full-time job, his agenda filled with appointments to kill whatever was killing him. A lifetime before I had to cradle him in and out of bed, he carried me on his shoulders over the jetty at the port. Minutes after I'm called to the hospital, I remember that day, sitting together on a rock, watching the ships glide past us, when he told me that years before he was my father, he was a port pilot in Havana, steering ships safely into harbor, then guiding them out to sea again, never to see them again, seconds before I hear his last breath, told to leave the room.
And this is Richard Blanco reading his poem, The Port Pilot, from his latest collection of poems, Looking for the Gulf Motel. What did it mean to you when your father told you he'd been a port pilot in Havana? Why did that have such a big effect on you? Because of the responsibility that he had, or because of the fact that he was guiding the ships to safety and they'd never know who he was?
Well, I mean, I think that's an afterthought. As an adult at the time, I was much younger, and I just thought it was just neat as all hell. I mean, you got to understand the landscape of growing up in Miami, these huge, like, ships that we used to watch at, you know, going off into the Caribbean on sunset. And so I just thought it was so neat. But it was also sort of the story of my father, of how being such a sort of emotionally absent person that, you know, finding out these little bits and pieces about him and were so interesting to me. And since he died when I was relatively young, before I really was a really mature adult, I never got to sort of meet him in a way. And so through the poetry, I've gone back to these little tidbits and sort of tried to recreate him on the page and see what he meant to me and what our relationship was about.
So you were in your early 20s when your father died. How did that change your life?
In ways, not immediately at first, in the sense of, as I said, you know, my father's sort of emotionally distant. And so there wasn't that great sense of sort of someone who was my pal and my buddy kind of feeling. But it left an incredible, an even bigger hole in the sense of understanding that now I would never really be able to get to that moment with him. And I only understood that actually later in life. I mean, now when, you know, as I hit my late 20s, 30s, you know, my relationship with my mother is completely different. I've come to that relationship now as an adult, as a mature adult. We've hashed out a lot of things. I really know who my mother is now. And I always feel, you know, that I've never got the chance to do that with my father. So my life would change in ways not immediate, but in ways that I would see afterwards. And I think that's why he becomes a topic in my poetry a lot, to sort of understand what that relationship could have been in some way. I have to have some emotional outlet to understand that connection that never was. Immediately after, luckily, you know, the family stepped in terms of any financial hardship and all that. There wasn't anything sort of drastic in that context.
Your grandmother was a very important figure in your life, and you write about her in a few poems. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of one of those poems, and it's called Queer Theory, According to My Grandmother. Do you want to introduce it for us?
Oh, sure. So my grandmother was as xenophobic as she was homophobic. I remember growing up so that anything that was seemed culturally odd or weird or strange was also sort of tagged as queer. And I'm talking like things like Legos and Fruit Loops. So anything that she perceived as strange, she also questioned in terms of my sexuality. And so I think that's where this poem sort of gets its a lot of its sort of energy from. But it was also, my grandmother was a very central figure in my life. It's one of those relatives that end up doing a lot of good for you in terms of all the harm that they did to you. And so this poem, which I thought at first was this very poignant, angry, bitter poem. First time I read it, people just were like laughing in their seats. And then I got the humor behind this, and I realized how I was treating the subject. And this is in the voice of my grandmother.
And this is your Cuban grandmother, who was your father's mother.
Yes, my father's mother.
Yeah. Okay.
Queer theory, according to my grandmother. Never drink soda with a straw. Milkshakes? Maybe. Stop buying your mother's Avon catalog and the men's underwear and those Sears flyers. I've seen you. Stay out of her Tupperware parties and perfume bottles. Don't let her kiss you. She kisses you much too much. Avoid hugging men, but if you must, pat them real hard on the back, even if it's your father. Must you keep that cat? Don't pet him so much. Why don't you like dogs? Never play house, even if you're the husband. So the poem goes on to catalog all these sort of atrocities my grandmother used to say. Towards the end, I'll pick it up about two-thirds into the poem towards the end. Don't watch Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie. Don't stare at the $6 million man. I've seen you. Never dance alone in your room. Donna Summer, Barry Manilow, The Captain, Antoniel, Bette Midler, and all musicals, forbidden. Posters of kittens, Star Wars, or the Eiffel Tower, forbidden. Those fancy books on architecture and art, I threw them in the trash. You can't wear cologne or puka shells, and I better not catch you in clogs. If I see you in a ponytail, I'll cut it off. What? No, you can't pierce your ear, left or right side. I don't care. You will not look like a goddamn queer. I've seen you, even if you are one.
Great poem. How did you respond to your grandmother at the time when she was giving you all these do's and don'ts, mostly don'ts?
That's a good question. I think I've written a few essays sort of retracing what that meant and how it affected me. And one of the things that I realized is what it made me was a very sort of self-conscious child, and therefore much more introverted than maybe I was naturally, and a great observer of the world, because I had to understand how to react. I had to pick up how people were perceiving me, in other words, so that I knew how to respond, or at least that was my interaction with my grandmother. You know, sit straight, don't fold your legs, you know, cross your legs, don't do this, you know, don't say things this way, do, you know, all that stuff. So it made me very self-conscious, but at the same time, I learned the skill of how to read people and read people's sort of emotions. And I think in part, I don't want to attribute all this to my grandmother, but I think in part that made me, I mean, as writers, as poets, what do? I mean, we sit back and sort of watch the world and observe what maybe other people miss. And I think that's part of how I became interested in writing in some way subconsciously.
Did you try to win your grandmother's approval by trying to fix yourself in her eyes and, you know, not listen to musicals or Bette Midler or look at your mother's Avon catalogs or any of the things you urge, you know, have a cat,
the things
urged you not to do because it was too effeminate.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, every you know, of course I wanted my grandmother's love and approval. So, at every turn I would try to please her and try to do things that I – well, and everything I did, there was always the before thought of would my grandmother like this, and literally almost everything I did. So you never knew what you were going to get. You know, sometimes I'd do something or say something or ask for something that would be met with okay, and then sometimes there was these other responses that you can stand. But nonetheless, yeah, I remember my grandmother – I always wanted to be in the Cub Scouts, and to her, that was queer.
The Cub Scouts, really?
So you would think the Cub Scouts, you know, boys camping.
Yeah,
Kind of, because it was this also this cultural component. It's like, what is that? You know, that's queer.
So you live in Maine, where it's now legal to be married, and my understanding is that you and your partner, Mark, might at some point in the future get married. You have a poem about him I want you to read. And just to preface this, you know, you grew up in Florida, but now you live in Maine because it's
great.
Where he has lived, and I guess where his work is too. So that must be quite an adjustment living in the Maine climate, especially after big snowstorms like the one you recently had. But anyways, the poem I want you to read is called Killing Mark. It's not what it seems. You're welcome to introduce this or to just jump in and read it.
Okay.
And this is going to be an excerpt of the poem. We're just trying to squeeze in a lot of poems, so I've been asking you to excerpt them.
What's always sort of surprised me about this poem a little bit is that it is obviously Killing Mark. It's the title. It's about my partner. It's about me in a gay relationship. And yet, in the small town where I live in Bethel, this is one of the favorite poems, which is greeted with such enthusiasm, because I think what it speaks about is something that's really transcends a gay relationship. I mean, it's just something fundamental, and one understands a gay relationship is a relationship. So, Killing Mark. His plane went down over Los Angeles last week again. Or was it Long Island? Boxer shorts, hair gel, his toothbrush washed up on the shore of New Haven, but his body never recovered, I feared. Monday, he cut off his leg chainsawing, bled to death slowly while I was shopping for a new lamp. Never heard my messages on his cell phone. Where are you? Call me. I told him to be careful. He never listens. Tonight, 15 minutes late, I'm sure he's hit a moose on Route 26, but maybe he survived. Someone from the hospital will call me, give me his room number. I'll bring his pajamas, some magazines. 5:25. Still no phone call. Voicemail full. I turn on the news, wait for the report. Flashes of moose blood, his car mangled, as I buzz around the bedroom, dusting the furniture, sorting the sock drawer. By 7:30, I'm taking mental notes for his eulogy, suddenly adoring all I've hated, 10 years worth of nose hairs in the sink, of lost car keys, of chewing too loud and hogging the bed sheets, when Joel yowls, ears to the sound of footsteps up the drive, and darts to the doorway. I follow with a scowl. Where the hell were you? Couldn't you call? Translation: I die each time I kill you.
I really like that poem. Who hasn't done that? Who hasn't had those horrible imaginings when the person they love is late?
I had a friend of mine who told me you can divide the world into two kinds of people: those that panic when you don't call in 5 minutes, and those that have no idea that they're the ones who are not calling.
So what does Mark think of that poem?
He likes it. It makes him chuckle as well. I think he totally gets it and understands. And it hasn't changed his behavior whatsoever. So He knows it's a love poem at the end of the day. And I think it helped him to understand sometimes why I do get so out of control and neurotic. It's not out of I have that sense of that something's going to slip away any minute. Something I try to get better at in my day-to-day life and with other things, but that sense of impending doom and panic that sort of, I guess, follows maybe poets around. I'm not sure.
Since so many of your poems are about what does it mean for you to be an American with two Cuban parents who it sounds like they never quite fully adjusted to America, never fully got the English language, and you were very much of both worlds and, you know, feeling in between worlds and so on. So now that you've given the, you know, now that you've written and given the inaugural poem for President Obama's second inauguration, has that just affected your feelings of what it means for you to be an American?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's in a way that I hadn't expected. It's been an incredible, incredible experience, and not to the moment where I was up there and finished reading the poem exactly. I mean, that whole process of being in the platform was amazing. This is going to be a long answer. So. Well, part of what I grew up with and part of what's in one of the other two inaugural poems is that, ironically, growing up in an exile or immigrant family, there's actually a more heightened sense of those idealistic or those ideals of American, of America. And so we grew up with very high expectations of America. It's not that my parents – yes, my parents didn't adjust fully, but it was almost as if because of how much they held up America and those values, they were instilled in us in ways that perhaps other people – might take for granted. So I always grew up with these ideals of America. And then living in Miami, which is a very culturally insulated place for many years, I grew up watching, I thought America was what I saw in the Brady Bunch and picture books of pilgrims and whatnot. I really believed the whole sort of American dream, the whole idealistic vision of America, because what was around me didn't feel like America because everybody was Cuban like us. So then I really thought Miami was sort of like this sort of benevolent sort of purgatory between Cuba and the real America. It was like this holding pen. And since we weren't rich, I'd never visited another American city till I was in my 20s. So I really didn't know any better. So all along, I'm going along with this through different stages of my relationship with America, psychologically and perhaps, I've always been sort of wondering, where's home? Is home America? You know, that ideal doesn't really exist, does it? I mean, where are all those sort of principles that I, you know, grew up with? And when I was up on that platform for those two hours or so that we were up there, it was like all those ideals came to life and in ways that I had never imagined. And so even though all the politics and all the physical cliff and all the rest that was going on for those 2 hours, there was still this sense that was so pure about America, that sense of that transfer of power, or that just the idea that all those hundreds of thousands of people have just come to bear witness. I never got that. I'm like, why would people go to the inauguration and sit down there in the cold for one moment? Beyonce, James Taylor, President Obama, all the representatives, all the senators were there for one purpose. And it was so powerful that it was something that it was a principle to come to life that we've as a country, as people, have not been able to mess up in some ways. At least maybe I was in the moment, my poetic moment, but I really, really embraced America up there like I had never before. And I think I finally felt like I was home in some way, not perhaps an idealistic home that I had thought, but really home. And I turned to my mother at one moment and I told her, well, I think we're finally American.
Richard Blanco's latest collection of poems is called Looking for the Gulf Motel. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's interview with Emily Bazelon, author of the new book Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Bazelon says bullying has changed over the years, and that because of the constant connectivity provided by cell phones and laptops, today's bullying never stops, even when you're alone in your bedroom. Bazelon started writing about bullying in a series for Slate back in 2009. She's now a senior editor there. She's also the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School and frequently writes about legal issues.
Emily Bazelon, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write about bullying?
I got interested in bullying when I started reading stories in the newspaper a few years ago about cyberbullying. And it was sort of treated as this brand new alarming phenomenon. And I'm a mother. I have kids who are 10 and 13. And I was interested in how the internet is changing what it's like to grow up. So that was sort of the point of entry for my investigation.
And what about some of your concerns as a parent?
I think that technology use is just such a struggle for parents right now. It's so different than when we were growing up. Cell phones, social media, all of these things that are incredibly important to kid culture that we just didn't experience. So I wanted to think about, through my reporting, what kind of limits make sense to set, how you make sure to give your kids some oversight when they start with all these new technologies.
So how do you think cyberbullying has changed life for the victim of bullying?
So first of all, it really can make bullying feel like it's 24/7. You know, when I was growing up and I was a teenager and I had an experience of having this moment where my friends fired me, which I can say now kind of dryly, but at the time was intensely painful. When I got home from school, there was a break. I didn't have to deal with them directly, and I could sort of put myself back together in the afternoon and evening. Whereas now, when you come home, if you're a victim of bullying, you're likely to see this kind of continue on social media site or via texting. And it's really hard for kids not to look when they think there's some mean thing being spread around about them. And then the other change for them is because it's being written down, it can feel very kind of permanent and visible. And the bullying can take place in front of quite a large audience.
So in one of the bullying stories that you tell in your book, the kids start a Let's Start Drama site on, is it on Facebook that they do this?
Yeah, it's a group page on Facebook that hundreds of kids join. And it's set up anonymously by probably a girl. Everyone thought it was a girl, but someone who wasn't identified. And she used the site for a couple things. One was to put gossip out there in a sort of, you know, gossip sheet way where the whole school was reading it. And another was to pit kids against each other in these contests. For girls, it would be who's prettier. For boys, it would be who would win in a fight. And there were real fights and real arguments that came out of the site.
But there was a lot of real bullying that ended up on the site too, right?
Yeah, exactly. It really caused an enormous amount of conflict and trouble in the school, and it was a real challenge for adults at the school to handle because it was all taking place online and not in school, but the ramifications were coming into the school.
And are there rules on Facebook that should theoretically prevent a Facebook site from being used to bully people?
Yes. And that page is actually an easy call because it was set up with a made-up email address. And Facebook has what it calls real name culture, where you're supposed to use your real name for everything. And so when the adults at that school reported it as being fake, it should have come down, but it didn't.
Why didn't it?
Well, when I spent a day at Facebook, I talked to them about this particular page, and they looked up the history of it. I was spending time with the people who handle all the abuse complaints, and there's an enormous volume of complaints, so they are working through them really quickly and doing the best they can. But in this instance, they just missed the report. They just had the initial complaints had gotten ignored, and then they had put an auto-ignore message on all the future ones that had come in. So once they knew about it from me, they took it down. It was a clear violation of their rules, but they had not caught it on their own.
So it was you who got it taken down?
Yes. They sort of said, well, you know, now it has to come down. And I thought, well, you know, the school is going to be better off without it, so I think that's okay.
Well, you know, this whole issue of cyberbullying raises the question, when is it appropriate for parents, when is it appropriate for schools to intervene, and when is it really none of their business? And what are some of the thoughts that you've developed on that?
You know, I think this is a huge challenge for schools. I mean, we don't make schools responsible for all the stuff that kids do at the movies or on the beach or walking down the street. And yet, if there's a cruel thread on Facebook or Twitter or a bunch of mean, you know, harassing texts go around, it's very typical for parents to bring those into the school and ask for help because they naturally feel that since it's among students, the school should have some role. I think it's clear that schools can help kids and parents talk through these situations. What I think is much trickier is whether they can really take on the role of punishing. And there are some legal questions about that, about students' free speech rights. And then there's also this bigger organizational questions. Are schools really set up to police all this behavior that's taking place off campus? And do we really want them to play that role?
In one of the stories about cyberbullying that you tell, a guidance counselor becomes aware of one of the students who's being cyberbullied, and the guidance counselor decides to intervene. At what point did she decide it was appropriate to intervene, and what did she do?
At her school, the standard was that if she thought a student's safety was at risk, that she had to take action. And so what happened was a girl came into her office very upset about some posts on a site called Formspring, yet another social media site in which there's a lot of anonymity. And the posts were really over the top. They were, you know, baiting her into committing suicide and revealing very private details about her life. And for this girl, it was devastating. And she was walking around feeling incredibly nervous and worried and anxious. So the guidance counselor actually couldn't access the site in school and went home that night and logged on and started looking around at this girl's page, which led her to lots of other students. And she found a lot of material that really distressed her. So she reported it to the site as a violation, though no action was taken. And then she started calling around to the parents and saying, you know, I need to let you know what your kids are doing. And then the final step she took, which I think is really interesting, was she wrote a note to the kids, knowing that a lot of them would see it. And she said, you know, look, I'm your guidance counselor, and I just wanted you to know I'm here, and I'm seeing a lot of disturbing things you're writing, and it's troubling to me. And she heard about, you know, over the next few days in school that a bunch of kids had stopped using the site simply because she had shown up there.
I think a lot of parents fear that their children are growing up without a sense of boundaries, that there are boundaries that you don't cross in another person's life. People are entitled to privacy. And sometimes social media just totally violates boundaries. And so do you feel like there's some kind of, training or discussion that needs to be had for children who are growing up with social media, who don't know a world without it, and who only, you know, who are growing up in a world where there aren't boundaries?
I think it's really important. You know, we don't just like toss our kids out the door at midnight and expect them to thrive in the outside world. And in the same way, when they're going online for the first time, just talking through with them what you think the norm should be is important. And I think that's especially key because these sites are encouraging kids to share widely and habitually. That's good for their business models. The more brand loyalty they can build among kids and teenagers, and the more they can habituate all of us to just sharing, the more money they make. So we need to make sure to help kids think about whether they really want to be putting intimate details, intimate photographs about their lives online. And so I know as a parent, that's something that I've really tried to be wary of. And I know, you know, for my kids, they would tell you that it's incredibly bad luck to have a mother who is writing a book about cyberbullying just as they're becoming teenagers. But I really do feel like they can't hear too often that there are consequences to what you write online and that they need to be aware of that.
Have they faced consequences yet?
They haven't, you know, partly I think because of this book. They know they really have to behave themselves right now. We did have a dilemma, my husband and I, about when to get our older son a cell phone. So he started a new school for seventh grade this year, and he wanted a phone. All the kids had a phone. We had delayed. We thought he could handle it. We got him what we call a dumb phone instead of a smartphone, one that he can text on and make calls, though he never calls anyone. He only texts, really, but not one that has the internet. And that's a kind of continuing battle in my house. But I feel like for right now, that's like an incremental step he can take, a more one-on-one kind of communication. And I want to make sure that he has mastered that before he moves on to social media.
No internet, because that means no social media.
Right. I mean, he uses the internet at home. I don't want to make us sound like total purists, but I just don't see why a 13-year-old kid needs to have the internet, access to the internet in his pocket all day. That just seems like too much to me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Emily Bazelon. She's a senior editor at Slate and author of a new book about teenage bullying called Sticks and Stones. One of the things you did as part of your research is you spent a day at Facebook to see how they're dealing with bullying and complaints about bullying. And they were actually in the process of devising a program to try to help young people who were the victims of bullying. Has that program gone into effect?
You know, it has, and they've done more work on it, and I'm glad you asked me because this is one good thing I can say about Facebook. They started working with some psychologists from Yale and Berkeley this year to figure out how to better respond to kids when they complain about bullying and harassment. And when the psychologists actually brought in some real kids, the kids said, you know, we want to feel like it's more of a conversation as opposed to sort of sending a message in a bottle and feeling like there's no response or a very automated response. So now Facebook is testing with 13 and 14-year-olds responses that are more tailored to what the kids say is happening and that do more to encourage them to share negative content with someone they trust in their own lives. And that's a good idea because it's the people who are around you who know what the context is.
What are your own ground rules for whether you should or shouldn't or when you should look at your own children's social networking? And one of your children is a teenager and one is a preteen. Do I have that right?
That's right. So right now my kids are not on social media, but when they go on, I'm planning from the beginning to say to them, look, I need to have your password, at least in the beginning. I want to help guide you through this world. And one of the reasons I feel that strongly is because of a mistake my husband and I made when we got our older son a cell phone. We didn't say, you know, in the beginning, we just want to scroll through your text, not because we don't trust you, just to sort of make sure you're getting the hang of this. And then we realized he was texting a lot from looking at the phone bill. And we thought, you know, we should talk to him about this. But at that point, he considered this to really be a private zone. And he got very upset and felt like we didn't trust him. So I think it's so important to set a kind of stricter standard in the beginning. And then you can ease up as you see that your kid is handling this new world in a smart way.
Now, one of the people who you write about in your book, Sticks and Stones, a book about bullying, is the story of a gay teenager who was bullied at school because he was gay. And he ended up taking his case to the court. Why did he take it to the court?
So this is a boy named Jacob Lasher in upstate New York. And he was a kid who in 7th and 8th grade started painting his fingernails and dyeing his hair. And in his community, that was just not normal behavior, not acceptable behavior. And the other kids started giving him a really hard time. And it was just continuous harassment. I mean, when you read the court documents, it's just a really sad story of a boy, you know, having his phone broken and being pushed down the stairs and being insulted very regularly in school. And finally, his parents just reached a breaking point. They felt like they had complained to the principal and the superintendent so many times and no effective action was being taken for their son. And so as a last resort, they went to the New York Civil Liberties Union and said, do we have any legal recourse here? And because this bullying really was about both Jacob's sexual orientation, because by then he had come out as gay, and also the way in which he just wasn't conforming to the stereotypes we have about boys, there was a way that they could bring a lawsuit. And they were able both to get the school to institute some reforms and also to win some money for their son.
So what were the grounds for the suit?
The grounds for the suit were equal protection. So the idea that everybody has the same right to go to school and boys and girls have to be treated the same. And then Title IX, which protects students against sexual harassment, including sexual harassment on the basis of your sexuality. And then finally, in New York State, there is a law that directly protects students from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation.
So was part of the premise of the suit, if a girl was being treated that way by boys, she probably would have been more protected by the school than this gay boy was?
Right. And also the idea that kids shouldn't have to act a particular way because they're a boy or a girl, that you should be able to be a boy who can wear nail polish and dye your hair. And that should be something the school should be able to handle.
So what are your guidelines, your personal guidelines for when you think it's appropriate or inappropriate for a parent to contact either the school or law enforcement about their child being bullied?
I think if something's happening in school, if there's a connection to school, it's absolutely appropriate for parents to ask for help from the school. And what you want to do before you make that, what you want to do before you take that step is to make sure you have all the facts straight. You know, it's of course your job to be your advocate for your kid, but sometimes what will seem like a simple kind of one-way bullying street will turn out to be more complicated. And so you want to at least find out all the facts. Also, if it turns out that it really is bullying that's happening and that your child is victimized, the more evidence you have, the better you can make your case. So that's the place that I recommend starting. Going to the police can be helpful for cyberbullying if the school tells you there's just nothing they can do about this online harassment. But I think that is a more dramatic and potentially problematic step to take because the cops can handle it well. There are a lot of police officers now trained to work in schools who will kind of give verbal warnings to kids in a way that can be effective. But when you think about what happened in South Hadley, the involvement of the police and the prosecutors was, you know, incredibly heavy-handed. And so that's a way in which turning to law enforcement can make this into a much bigger escalated problem than with big consequences for teenagers in a way that may not be what is really appropriate.
This South Hadley case was a case in which six teenagers were charged with leading to the suicide of the person who they had bullied, and they were facing up to 10 years in prison, which they didn't get.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess I should say I hope you never have to deal with your children being bullied or cyberbullied.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. They know that while this book is coming out, they have to be on their best behavior.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Emily Bazelon is the author of the new book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.